Let's get going now.
From KMOX Sports.
We're primed and ready.
All day, baby.
Man, let's go.
This is the Graybar Sports Open Live. Graybar, your distributor for electrical and datacom needs on 104.1 FM, KMOX.
Graybar Sports Open Line on this Wednesday evening. Nate Gatter with you in for Matt Pauly. Matt will be back on Friday when the Major League All-Star break concludes and the Cardinals resume their season against the Arizona Diamondbacks in Phoenix. Late first pitch will be an 8:40 first pitch Central Time. Between the Cardinals and the D-backs on Friday. Road trip for St. Louis out of the All-Star break. Brendan Donovan had a couple of hits. The lone Cardinals All-Star representative down in Atlanta last night, a game that ended in a swing-off. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the show. We have lots of guests to come. First up will be Daniel Estevi. He'll join us in about 10 minutes. Daniel, you might remember from his time here in St. Louis for a few years reporting at Fox 2, where he covered St. Louis City as well as, I think, any television reporter in the city for my money. And he is now back in Dallas, his hometown, at CW33 there in Dallas. And City and FC Dallas play each other on Saturday, so a perfect reason to check in with Daniel and preview that match a little bit, with St. Louis City coming off a 2-1 victory over Portland on Sunday at Energizer Park. 6:35, we'll visit with Derek Gould of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Just talk generally about where the Cardinals are right now and, of course, look ahead toward the deadline now a couple of weeks away and what the Cardinals' plans might be, what he's hearing. Also, I think we might touch base with him on an article that he wrote and something that's been getting more coverage in the last couple of days, which is kind of the increasing temperature already between Major League Baseball and the Players Association. The CBA comes, the collective bargaining agreement comes to an end at the end of next season. I think a lot of folks around the industry feel that a strike is a very real possibility, at the very least, a significant strife. I guess I shouldn't use strife and strike that close to each other to mean two different things, but that there's going to be some friction, shall we say. There already is, and that friction is likely to create real problems between Major League Baseball and the Players Association over the next year and a half, and that could be problematic then for what the 2027 season looks like. That's probably a complicating factor in the television deal negotiations that Major League Baseball is still trying to wrap up right now to square away how ESPN's television rights for the next 3 years, 26, 27, and 28, are going to shake out, because ESPN and MLB mutually opted out of that, which was silly of Major League Baseball to do, but ESPN was probably going to opt out anyway, so it really doesn't matter. And they now need television rights for their prime properties, at least their prime regular season properties, for the remainder of the existing deals, and they don't want to commit to anything beyond 2028 because that's when everything else comes up, and they want to be able to sell all the television rights together going into 2029. So that's probably complicated further by the possibility, at least, of a strike that could affect the 27 season. We'll talk to Derek about maybe not so much the television element of it, but we'll also touch on the labor dispute that is looming between Major League Baseball and the Players Union. Talk about the Cardinals, as we just did for a while on Redbird Rush Hour with Kevin Wheeler. You can go back and hear that on the free Odyssey app in podcast form. Some good discussion there about where the Cardinals are right now, the transition happening between the symbolic first and second halves of the season, either side of the All-Star break, the transition from pre to post trade deadline, which is going to be the most significant pole, if you will, marking stick of the Cardinals season. And then the transition that's happening on an overarching level between John Mozeliak and Chaim Bloom running baseball operations for the Cardinals, which is probably, when we look back on this season, and certainly when we look ahead at the next 12 months or so, going to be the biggest piece of the Cardinals' narrative. That's going to be the biggest thing for this offseason, is how does it differ with Chaim Bloom in charge? And it might be quite significant. I think it probably is likely that the ripples of that will be felt throughout the offseason and will be a primary talking point this winter for the Cardinals. We'll visit with Jonathan Mayo of MLB.com during the second hour. Jonathan is one of the two people, along with Jim Callis, who primarily cover the MLB draft for MLB.com. We will discuss the Cardinals draft class, also a little bit of the draft in bigger picture. 7:30, we'll visit for the first time of two in the next 2 days with Dan Reardon, KMOX golf analyst, talking about the Open Championship, which will get underway just after midnight this evening, local time. It'll be Thursday in Northern Ireland at Royal Portrush, where the first round will get underway. Dan will be back with us again tomorrow evening as well to analyze and break down the first 18 holes of the 72 at the Open Championship for the Claret Jug, golf's oldest trophy. And at the end of the show, we will talk to Ed Wheatley, who is president of the St. Louis Browns Historical Society, kind of an interesting benchmark as well in St. Louis Browns history over the last couple weeks that occurred, and we will talk to Ed all about that. So, as you can tell, it's going to be a busy couple of hours. So glad that you're with us on 104.1 FM, on any of our streams across Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, or on the free Odyssey app where you can listen live to everything that we do on KMOX. You can listen to Cardinals baseball, to St. Louis City soccer, all of that. If you want to join the conversation, there are so many ways to do it. The first is on that free Odyssey app. You can tap the talk back feature and leave us a voice message that we can play on the air. You can comment on the streams on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube. You can send us a tweet at KMOX Sports. You can call us at 314-436-7900. That's 314-436-7900. John Camp is standing by, the producer in our downtown studios, to take your calls, and he is newly qualified to do that. He's allowed to do it on his own now because he turned 25 yesterday. He used to have someone help him answer the phone, but now he's allowed to do it all on his own like a big boy. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. It's absolutely right.
That is what I heard. That's the biggest. You can rent a car and answer the studio phone on your own. So yep. Very, very exciting. Was it a good birthday, John?
It was. You know, we had a good time with the family. It's about all I really hope for 25. I don't really have any really big ones to look forward to other than 30. So
yeah, that's how you can tell you're starting to get old, that you're like, that's the best I could hope for.
I know next year I have to find everything, you know, like insurance plans. Yep. And yeah, it's time to really grow up and be an adult.
So if that doesn't get you excited for Gray Bar Sports Open Line, I don't know what will. John will be here. I will be here. Hopefully you will be here as well. Daniel Esteve will be here on the other side of the break. St. Louis City Talk coming up next. Just getting underway. Gray Bar Sports Open Line on KMOX. Gray Bar Sports Open Line continues. Daniel Esteve is on the phone with us. Daniel, you know from his time in St. Louis reporting at Fox 2, he is now back in Dallas at CW33, which is sad for us, but convenient this week because City go down to Dallas to play FC Dallas on Saturday. So Daniel is the perfect guy. Daniel, we are so glad to have you. How you doing?
Nate, I'm smiling ear to ear, man, just to be chatting with you specifically, and obviously back with the great people in St. Louis. To say, though, that I'm the perfect guy has and always will be quite the stretch, but I'm excited nonetheless to chat to you.
So obviously there's some positivity for St. Louis City and the scale of, you know, this season. You have to take the rays of hope where they come. And two goals in the second half for Marcel Hartl to come from behind and beat Portland certainly counts as a ray of hope. There was 53% possession. City completed more passes than Portland. They outshot them by quite a bit. Just in general, not a City-looking box score. And now they get, as road games go, a winnable game on paper against an FC Dallas team that has struggled quite a bit. Stylistically, with City transitioning a little bit now and trying to come out of the ice age of the Olaf Melberg era, how do you see this matchup playing out in terms of just the tactics on Saturday?
Hopefully better than just your average pillow fight, because a couple months back, you honestly could have looked at these two teams and said, man, they're very, very similar. Mild expectations on both ends, both kind of floating around playoff spots, but underwhelming for the better part of the season. Now, obviously, St. Louis City, which I can proudly say I can just watch from afar as a fan now, which is such a great experience for me, having covered the team for so long since its inception. You and I both, for that matter. I mean, City probably had the extra antics that have come with this season: new coaches, change, issues with the ownership, player issues. FC Dallas hasn't quite had that much, but at least with the on-field expectations, very, very similar. I think City-wise, Yes, they are trying to play a bit more forward pressing, a bit more attacking, but that's always been the mantra for Eric Quill here at FC Dallas. He's new. He came over from New Mexico United, and his MO is very direct. He said if he can score goals, he told me this before the season, with as few passes as possible, that would be a best case scenario. Now, the only problem with that is his very best player, Lucho Acosta, is great on the ball and is great at working in passes. So there's almost been a conflict of interest in that regard. So I anticipate two very confused styles of play come Saturday, and to see who's going to win will be probably the most interesting part of this matchup.
Yeah, something tells me Lucho Acosta did not hear let's press, win the ball and fire away and smile ear to ear.
Not quite. You talk about the bleak positivity. I go back to the FC Dallas's matchup against Cincinnati earlier this year. Just an absolute slugfest. I think over six goals in that matchup on the road. And it was really the only, I don't even think the result was very good. This is a couple months back. It was more so just the fight, the ability to come back, because it looked so bleak from an FC Dallas perspective, as if there was already no hope. But at least it pumped a little bit of life into this team that at the time was still very much hovering around that 10th, 11th spot in the West. But it's just been such a confusing season. Certainly something that I think a lot of St. Louis City fans feel as well.
Yeah, that game was kind of a mess, that the Lucho Acosta return to Cincinnati, and how I think he was treated very differently than he anticipated he would be, and just it felt very, very messy. And that's going to be interesting. Speaking of you and I having covered St. Louis City since its inception, I don't know that we've really had that yet, where certainly we haven't had a player return and get any animosity from the crowd in that way. And I'm not sure the levels of intensity around the fans feeling towards City right now are high enough that they could muster up a whole lot of animosity, but at some point it's going to happen, and it would be really interesting to experience Energizer Park when it's kind of out for blood like that. As outside of maybe the Kansas City matches in the first year, which were pretty emotionally charged, there haven't been a lot of those really high temperature kind of games.
You haven't really needed it, so to speak, and I can think of maybe a handful of games where maybe the St. Louis Blues fans have gotten pretty aggressive. I mean, heck, even to Jordan Kyrou at one point, shortly after Craig Berube walked out the door. But I can think of that first playoff series, I want to say 2021, when he had that issue with the Minnesota Wild. There was some animosity toward the Wild bench. That's the only time I can really think of St. Louis fans getting too aggressive. And I always go back to one.
Nazem Kadri, too, and that didn't work out too well for the Blues.
I remember that one vividly, exactly. And I can think about a very direct quote. Monty, the big lefty, when he came over to St. Louis, our first interview with him in the Cardinals clubhouse after having played for the New York Yankees, he said, "Well, man, you guys are a lot easier to deal with than the New York media." And I imagine the same can be said for the fans. St. Louis fans are great, great fans, but Energizer Park in particular, I can't imagine ever being this absolutely hellacious place to play, not from an energy standpoint. It's always had that, but just from an animosity perspective. I think visiting players, in fact, they love playing in there because it's just good energy all around, which is a credit to the fans, but also, to your specific question, tough to imagine us really berating a couple new players as they make their return, especially a guy like, yeah, I think Indy Vasilev, if he ever makes his return to Energizer Park, that's somebody that I'm sure will love to celebrate because of his antics on and off the field. Just a great player.
Yeah, no, certainly there have been some of those guys who have been, if anything, sad departures. You know, I think the same thing with returns for guys like Tim Parker, even someone, you know, there have been a couple other guys, you know, maybe some that are kind of neutral departures, but I don't think there's anybody who would inspire any sort of negative feelings in that way. And, you know, some of it is also just about, it's not that Cincinnati fans dislike Lucho Acosta in any way. Some of it is about, you know, spurned lover kind of situation. It's about how the departure happens rather than anything that happened during the tenure. And that's just, you know, you can't predict those things until the very end. In the spirit of Saturday's game, is there anybody aside from Acosta, maybe not such a big name, who you've had your eye on, who you think City fans should look out for in FC Dallas colors?
To be honest, I don't think there's anybody in particular that St. Louis City needs to be worried about. I mean, Nusep at the top is obviously a fantastic forward, and he's going to be on the end of a lot of those Lucho Acosta passes. So just that attack is always great. Just a player I'd love to see play, to be honest, in this matchup is Nolan Norris. He's been dealing with a lot of injuries lately, but he's a young 20-plus-year-old youth. U.S. international player who's just absolutely fantastic, kind of a Swiss Army knife, can play on the left side in a left back position, can play as a center back, can play as a central defensive midfielder. I think he's going to be so, so difficult to deal with for Major League Soccer teams moving forward. But he's just somebody that, oddly enough, we talk about animosity, Nate. He threw us a little bit of shade. And by us, I mean you and me, having called some of the City 2 games during that first season. Well, it turns out that semifinal, the following year that MLS Next Pro for St. Louis City lost to North Texas, when we thought they were going to return to the MLS Next Pro Championship, Nolan Norris was on that team, and it was a 3-0 victory in favor of North Texas. He was throwing some shade to City 2 at the time, thinking that for them, that was their MLS Next Pro Championship because they had so much respect for City 2. So, no, Nolan Norris is just a player who's in the top of my mind. I don't anticipate he'll play this weekend with his injury, but he's somebody to watch out for the future.
Do you know if you're going to get a chance to chat with any of the City guys who you have relationships with from when you were here?
I hope so. I've already spoken to a couple of the PR folks at St. Louis City. I know Cashon Smith won't be making the trip, but a couple of his colleagues and friends will be. So I'm already planning on meeting them. And then I'll try to see if I can, you know, sneak a conversation in, at least on the player side, with some of the players that I developed relationships with. I don't know if he's going to be there just because I'm a little bit removed, but any excuse to talk to John Hackworth, I will take. So I hope he's there. So plenty of people that I miss dearly. I'm hoping to actually get back to St. Louis sometime next month. So I'm planning on visiting as many people as possible, you included, Nate.
Yeah, well, we look forward to that. And certainly, yeah, any chance to talk to Hack is one worth taking. Last, this has nothing to do with St. Louis City, you know, and I'm sure your sources are in so deep that you just can't reveal anything. But while we have you here, the rumors are swirling around your Dallas Mavericks down there, around what they might do in the trade market, including names such as one LeBron James floating around. Are you thinking that the Mavs are primed to make a little more noise, even after maybe the last Nico Harrison blockbuster didn't go over so well?
You know, it's ironic because I was at Cooper Flagg's introductory press conference. I was at the post-draft press conference, and it seems like everything Nico Harrison has said, as crazy as some of the stuff he said is to date, they have come true. More specifically, the deal for D'Angelo Russell. He was very adamant that they were going to go get a point guard, somebody who could also play off the ball and be a scoring threat once Kyrie Irving returns. And lo and behold, first day of free agency, D'Angelo Russell is signed. Now, there were a couple other names thrown around there, but to our knowledge, LeBron James has not been one of those names that has been mentioned. And I just imagine that from an asset perspective, who are you going to throw that way, right?
Right.
I mean, from the question's been thrown around to Nico Harrison so often is he's talked about win-now mentality. Yes, LeBron James would 100% fit that mantra, but in the same vein, he now has a Cooper Flagg. So how much do you blow up the ship in an effort to win a championship as quickly as possible? And who do you give up in that same regard? PJ Washington was probably the top candidate to be sent the other way in any trade scenario. Giannis was one that was thrown around quite a bit. But three times in his post-draft press conference, Nico Harrison specifically mentioned asking PJ Washington about playing with Cooper Flagg, somebody who we identified as two players that play the exact same position. Well, here's Cooper Flagg ball handling in summer league, playing as a point guard, essentially, and PJ Washington is very much a part of next year's plan. So I just don't know how you make a trade like that in general, let alone one that includes a future Hall of Famer like LeBron James.
Yeah, it's good points all. I did, as much as this has mostly worked out for the Mavs, I had to roll my eyes at Nico Harrison in the press conference. I don't know if it was immediately after the lottery or a little later when he said, oh, you know, now, or maybe it was the Cooper Flagg introductory press conference when he said, now you guys see the vision.
It was.
Okay,
now
Nico.
Now you see the vision.
Yeah. You saw that all along. If only we could all have the foresight of Nico Harrison to know that the Mavs were going to win the lottery from outside the top 5% odds. What? Well, outside the top 10 percentage odds, right?
Nate, only bested by fortune favors the Bulls.
Yes,
which he did say in his post-draft press conference. And I can tell you, having sat in the second row, I think far off to the right side, you heard a couple chuckles in the media room when he said that. Of course, it was my first time face-to-face with the infamous GM, so I wanted to be on my best behavior. But my goodness, it was quite the quote. And he's only tried to top it with that other one. So It'll be interesting, but it's juicy nonetheless. Great gossip, at least right now.
Yeah, just for the press conferences at this point, want to see the Mavs win the championship this year, so Nico can walk in with a beer in one hand, a cigar in the other, and tell the media exactly what's on his mind.
You know, it'd be nice to see him loosen up a little bit. I think one of the other things that people maybe could have picked up on if they had seen the entire press conference, but some of the things he said specifically about Cooper Flagg and his relationship with coaches and former players and former teammates, quote for quote, said the exact same line at the introductory press conference. So I imagine there's a lot of prep. He has his lines always prepared, and Nico Harrison, for somebody who really doesn't love to talk, it seems, he's definitely keeps it within a lane. To see him loosen up, maybe have one or too many cocktails after a big celebration, it would be a pleasure and quite interesting to listen to him talk.
Well, always a pleasure to have you on these airwaves, sir. Appreciate you taking the time. Enjoy Saturday, and we'll see you back in St. Louis soon.
Always appreciate it, Nate. We'll talk to you guys soon, all right?
All righty. Daniel Esteve joining us, former Fox 2 reporter now at CW33 in Dallas. You can follow him everywhere at Daniel J. Esteve to get all of your Dallas insights and maybe a few lingering St. Louis City thoughts as well. Derek Gould will be with us to talk Cardinals after the break on KMOX. Graybar Sports Open Line continues on KMOX. Nate Gatter with you in for Matt Pauly, joined now by St. Louis Cardinals beat writer Derek Gould of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. You can follow him on Twitter at DGould. You can read all of his work on STL Today. Derek, thank you so much for taking a few minutes out of your All-Star break to visit with us.
You bet. Hope things are well back there in St. Louis.
We are doing our best. Another hot one today, but you know what? We're having a fun time anyway. You know, one of the themes of our Redbird Rush Hour earlier when I was talking to Kevin Wheeler was kind of the transition that's going on right now, right? A transitional year. This is a transitional period in the year around the deadline, and then the transition that is coming this offseason of Chaim Bloom taking over baseball operations for John Mozeliak. In that spirit, I think one of the things people have been wondering is how that balance of power is at the deadline right now, and how much input, assuming that John Mozeliak still has the final word as acting president still, how much input Chaim Bloom gets, knowing that he's going to be the one who mostly deals with the consequences of whatever moves the Cardinals make.
Yeah, I think you put it well right there. I mean, if there are consequences of the move that spill over into next year and beyond, then, you know, it's going to involve Chaim Bloom's influence, right? I mean, Mozeliak has been pretty clear about what he wants to do, there's some background noise there. Mozeliak's been pretty clear about, I wanted to make sure they weren't calling my name. Mozeliak's been pretty clear about what they want to do as far as roster-wise, as far as the handover, about everything that he wants in place when Chaim takes over. And, you know, he's talked about it being a clean slate. That obviously isn't going to be the case, but he wants to at least give them, you know, the information that they have kind of cleared this space for all this playing time. And all under that umbrella would also go these trades. If they're going to trade from the future, then that's Chaim's future. If they're going to trade to add to the future, then that's Chaim's future. Both of them, Mozeliak's talked about it. You know, Chaim isn't as, publicly out there talking and everything out of respect for Mo at this point. But, you know, they've all kind of discussed that, you know, this is a team. They work together and they get input from all categories before making a decision. And Mozeliak has said, you know, his job is to lead baseball operations until it's not. So does that give him the final say? I mean, not really, because ownership always has the final say. That's really the crux of it, right? And they've always had sort of a collaborative work going. This is just an additional voice within that collaborative work. And maybe Chaim has a bit more way on that collaborative work because it's his future. If that's the case, if it's his future that's in play, then he would be part of that conversation.
Derek Gould is with us, lead Cardinals writer at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Derek, how much do you think the Cardinals have their posture and sort of their mindset for the trade deadline set at this point, as opposed to how much is going to depend on the 13 games they have to play before the deadline?
It's a great question. You know, you don't want to make such small sample size decisions, and yet you could really see how the 13 days ahead here could at least nudge them in one direction or the other, or maybe more towards an extreme, which, you know, they just haven't really had the posture of here. They haven't really looked like a seller or a buyer, and this will come as no surprise to folks who follow them for a long time, fans or media. You know, they're like, well, how can they do a little bit of both? They don't want to go all in. They're not a team that really goes like, all right, well, we're just going to spend the future that we were just talking about, the one that we advertise, the one that they're saying this, that, you know, they advertise it all season that they were going to give space to the young players. And, you know, so why on, you know, in late July would they bail on that approach after they said, you know, we're advertising this to our fans that this is going to be the reset or transition year. But they could say, well, this team is better, so how do you outfit it with help without the cost of the future? And that's when you see a team make moves like they did last year, where they trade from depth, they trade from a spot where they weren't sure what they were going to get from Tommy Edmond, to get something that they need that also would help them in the year to follow, they hoped, in Eric Fetty. They kind of straddle the line a little bit, which has really been their method of operation for a long time now, is just kind of running within the bell curve as opposed to going to the tails of it.
With that in mind, that they might not be squarely in the bucket of buyer or seller, I wonder if it makes it a little more difficult to pin down guys who are likely to move, if at all. I mean, obviously, if you're a seller, the expiring relievers are always the first guys you look at. Ryan Helsley, Phil Maton, mm-hmm. Steven Matz. I wonder if, and obviously, you know, if they could get something for Eric Fetty, they'd probably look into that, considering that he might lose his rotation spot anyway. But considering that they might be straddling this line a little bit more, does that actually broaden the potential pool of players who could be in discussions? I mean, locally, there's been this Lars Nootbaar speculation now bubbling up. I think that's more talk than reporting, but still, does it broaden that player pool?
It does. It does indeed. Yeah. Then you start looking for spots where they have, you know, a bunch of players stacked up, or they feel like, okay, we've got an answer on this guy. Absolutely. I mean, if they could move Eric Fetty, they would definitely have that discussion. They've been open to it. And then they clear a spot, which is what they want to do for Michael McGreevy, right? Well, could they do that by acquiring something that helps them down the road, alleviating some salary, all of that? That is obviously very, very much agreeable. But it also allows them to look at, like, okay, what moves do you make that do add what they don't have in the system? Like, is there a play for a starting pitcher who they just don't have in the system, who could be around for another year, another 2 years? And do they feel that that would help them in a window to contend that would be, as we began the conversation, part of Heim's early years, right? And what's the pressure point or the cost point to pull that off? Because that would be a little bit different, right? That would be a prospect, but do they have a prospect in place or a position player in a place of depth where they can make that move? Absolutely. It opens all that up. It also helps, like, set the price, right? Like, if a team is going to come after Ryan Helsley, Cardinals know what the asking price, where it starts. Because he's an all-star closer. He obviously won the Closer of the Year award in the National League last year. He's a strong closer. He's exactly the kind of reliever that a team like the Phillies is looking for and some other teams, right? But he's also one that where the Cardinals could go, yeah, we're going to give him a qualifying offer at the end of the year. Worst case, we secure a draft pick, you know, or he accepts it because he wants to stay with the Cardinals, which Ryan has been pretty candid about, that he'd like to stick around. So you either then have the same situation next year, but then he doesn't have a qualifying offer attached to him, or you get the draft pick in response. So any trade is going to start there, right? It's got to outdo the compensation draft pick at the very least to get him. So you kind of start seeing, because of that, because of where they are, because of what they're looking at, because they can kind of play both sides of it, you start to understand, like, even what their asking price could be for certain players.
Yeah, obviously the trade deadline is going to dominate conversations over these next couple of weeks, but just to give you a brief reprieve from that, is there anything else that's flying under the radar because the focus is going to be on the deadline of guys you are watching or narratives that you're keeping an eye on for this last third or so of the season that you really want to keep an eye on for how it could affect next year and beyond?
I mean, Michael McGreevy's one, right? How many starts does he get in the second half? I guess you could break it down that way. How many starts does Michael McGreevy have in the second half? What does he do with them? And, you know, does that position him like they want for him to be part of the rotation next year? And then the other question, how many starts does Jordan Walker get? Where is Jordan Walker in the equation? You know, is he, he's down in double A, he's working on his swing. You know, the clock is ticking on how long he can stay there because he's on a rehab assignment. I don't really think the Cardinals have an appetite for optioning him from the majors back to double A. He's already a guy who is running out of options, to be candid, and that's a factor. You know, I mean, not within this calendar year, but, you know, within his career, he's running out of options. And so you have this situation where, like, has he maximized this quote-unquote runway and playing time in the same way that Alec Boston has? Not at all. And so do they today have more information about who he is, what kind of player he is, and what role he has in his, in their future, you know, as they wanted to? No, not at all. They don't. Do they have much more than they had in March? Do they have much more than they had in August 2024? Not really. So I think that's all part of it. I think those are some of the underlying things, and everything can trace back to the trade deadline because that's where we're at and that's where people will go with the conversation. But I think there's really some compelling things too about how you mentioned the next 13 days, not just for the trade deadline, but just for the Cardinals in general. How do they take advantage of that schedule with their style of play? Do they get some health back? What does Nolan Arenado provide? What does Lars Nootbaar provide? And do they start playing like they were in May? Because if they start playing like they did in May, they survived June, and that's to be complimented. That puts them back into the race pretty strongly, and it could happen in the 13 days.
Well, Derek, I could talk to you all evening long, but you got a flight to catch, and we want to make sure that you make it. So thank you so much for taking the time to visit with us, and we look forward to talking again soon.
You bet. They are not shy here about shouting at us. Holy cow. Sorry about that. The nice little ambient noise, as they call it.
But, yeah. Derek Gould reporting live from Hartfield-Jackson for KMOX.
No kidding. But they are serious about us lining up. Sure.
Well, you don't get in trouble on our behalf. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks.
Derek Gould visiting with us, lead Cardinals writer at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. You can follow him on Twitter at D Gould. We didn't get to talk about the labor discussions, but that'll be reserved for a future conversation. The good news is that's going to be bubbling under the surface, maybe at times bubbling up to the surface and then dipping back below for the next 18 months or so in some form or fashion. And so we'll have plenty of time to get to that. One more break in this hour. We'll get into our second hour guest as well. MLB draft conversation with Jonathan Mayo. Golf talk with Dan Reardon on the eve of the Open Championship. And we'll visit with president of the St. Louis Browns Historical Society, Ed Wheatley, as well about what's going on with them. Some final Cardinals thoughts when we return on KMOX. Nearing the halfway point of Gray Bar Sports Open Line this evening. Nate Gatter with you filling in for Matt Pauley. I'll be back tomorrow. Matt will return on Friday. Get those final thoughts probably for this evening on the Cardinals and that trade deadline situation. We conducted a Twitter poll, very scientific, yesterday, and 660-odd people voted, and the options were sell, buy, don't know yet on how they wanted the Cardinals to approach the deadline. Depending on exactly what time in the poll, roughly 70% said sell, and the remaining 30% was split up. I think it was finished around 18% by 12%. Not sure yet. Something like that. But the other 30% was split up on the other two options. I'm a little surprised that people are that sure, especially because if the Cardinals play well in the next 2 weeks and are in a wild card spot and trade pieces that have value, most likely Helsley, Maton, and Matz, and that hurts them, which it will, for the remainder of this year, I don't know that the average Cardinals fan is reacting too well to that, just based on what I know about the folks who sometimes call in to talk about the Cardinals here and the folks whose tweets we receive. I think there have to be a decent number of people in the 70%. I mean, that's what, 70% of 660. That's quite a significant number of people. That's what, 450 or so people.
It's around that margin.
Who are voting to sell. A significant number of those 450 or 400 or whatever it is have to be likely to get upset if it does hurt the team the remainder of this year and be in the camp of people who are saying that they're not going back to Busch Stadium because of XYZ, whatever reason, which is very popular to say right now. So I don't think you're wrong necessarily if you think sell. Although one of the things we talked about during the Redbird Rush Hour with Kevin Wheeler that you can go back and hear on the free Odyssey app is that Ryan Helsley does have a qualifying offer attached to him, and that came up in our chat just a moment ago with Derek Gould as well, that the Cardinals, at the very least, wouldn't take anything that's less valuable to them than the draft, the competitive balance draft pick they would get, effectively like a second-round pick, that they would get out of Ryan Helsley if he were to reject a qualifying offer and sign elsewhere in the offseason, assuming the Cardinals kept him all the way to the end. Or he takes the qualifying offer and the Cardinals keep him for a year on $20-ish million, which I think would be pretty agreeable to them, considering there's not a lot of risk in that deal. The Cardinals have relatively low payroll for the moment, so paying him, even if you're slightly overpaying him for what he's worth on a particular year, you're kind of getting that back in the minimal risk. I mentioned what camp people might be in, and so I think that means I have to bring in John Camp, who's standing by producing. John, what camp are you in?
I think I'm leaning towards sell a little bit, but it's probably in the I don't know, if I had to guess, because even if you go on and, let's say, win 10 of the next 13 before the deadline, who knows what the Brewers are going to do. They've been red hot.
Seven
the
in a
Cubs
row.
Look like they're probably not going to slow down. You could definitely be in a wild card spot, but I just don't feel like you're going to be a big buyer, which is what some fans want you to be, or a big seller.
Because the division is probably not happening, just not because the deficit is so big, but just because the Cubs have proven themselves to be a quality team, and then you have to deal with the Brewers also. So you have to pass two teams, and that's just hard. It's not out of the question, but I think that would be tough. Wildcard is definitely doable, even with the exact roster that they have.
You got to beat San Diego first, though.
It just doesn't really fire me up. You know, the idea of, oh, maybe we could get the third wild card.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm not sure I'm giving anything up for that.
It doesn't scream excitement.
Right. You could argue that keeping Ryan Helsley isn't giving a whole lot up, depending on what the market is. And, you know, the Cardinals know better than we do what the market is for him. And if it's not that hot, if it's not as hot as it would have been, say, in the offseason, which it wouldn't be quite as hot as it would have been in the offseason, maybe they say, we're not giving up much because, worst case, we get a draft pick and we get to keep Ryan for the rest of the year and use him to push toward the playoffs, which would do something to restore a little bit of how the fan base feels, to, as Kevin Wheeler pointed out, make a little bit of money on just playoff TV and gate revenue. Yep. Those are not insignificant things. I think I'm in that boat as well of probably sell, but not quite sure yet. I'm almost fearful that the Cardinals win 10 of their 13 between now and the deadline, because that is going to create...
And then they really won't know what to do.
Yeah, it's going to create a mess. The news is next, second hour on the other side. Gray Bar Sports Open Line on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Gray Bar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauly on KMOX.
Just kidding. Nate Gatter in for Matt Pauly this evening. Same story tomorrow. And Matt will be back on Friday when the Cardinals resume the second half of their season, so to speak. Although they've played nearly 100 games, they will be in Arizona Friday night, then Colorado, then home to play San Diego and Miami. We have already talked some St. Louis City. We visited with Daniel Esteve, former Fox 2 reporter, who is now at CW33 in Dallas. We talked to lead Cardinals writer Derek Gould of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch about the trade deadline, mostly a few other things. We will, in this hour, talk to Jonathan Mayo of MLB.com about the draft and the Cardinals' participation in said draft. We will also have Dan Reardon on. That'll be at the bottom of the hour. He talks golf here on KMOX. He'll visit with us tonight and again tomorrow, this evening, previewing the Open Championship, which begins at Royal Portrush in Northern Ireland tomorrow. And then tomorrow, of course, we will look back at the first round and ahead to the second. Ed Wheatley will be with us, president of the St. Louis Browns Historical Society, to wrap up this final hour of the show tonight. Before we get to those guests, Jonathan Camp is here producing for me this evening. And John, I wanted to talk a little bit about the All-Star game and the swing-off that ultimately ended it. I actually have been around quite a number of swing-offs. In fact, I called play-by-play for the first swing-off that ever decided a professional baseball game, at least a professional baseball game that was official and counted.
Really?
And that was in May of 2021, because the Frontier League used it that year to decide games. They would play one extra inning, and if it was not decided, then they would go to a three-man aside swing off. And I was doing games for the Gateway Grizzlies just across the river in Sauget at the time. And the Grizzlies won, I think it was 8-4 over a team from Quebec on opening day. It was an opening day doubleheader in 2021. So I have been around it. I think it can be fun in this setting. I think it's a silly way to decide a baseball game because it has very little to do with baseball itself. But in an all-star game setting, it's kind of appropriate because it's about style over substance. It's about entertainment. Yeah. And that's really what the evening is about. And it seemed to deliver, at least in that regard.
I felt like it was mainly more driven towards the entertainment facet of the game, because you go there to see the stars of all stars play, and to end the game with a miniature home run derby after, I'm pretty sure some people were already there the night prior when O'Neill Cruz and Cal Raleigh were hitting nukes left, right, and center. I thought it was a cool way to end the game. I mean, the fact that Aaron Boone decided to go with Jonathan Aranda, nothing against Jonathan Aranda, he's having a great year, but come up with that after Schwarber hits three on you to take the lead, I don't really get that decision, at least.
Yeah, so part of it is that, at least with the three guys that they had out there, is that some of the starters, I mean, I don't know if they would have been eligible anyway since they had come out of the game. Probably in the All-Star game, you say, who cares, put anybody out there. Apparently, a decent number of the starters weren't even in the building by that point.
They had already
the guy, they had already, you know, they showered, they changed, they're on flights, you know, back home or whatever, because their job is done and they want to get out of town while they have the opportunity, which I can understand. I mean, you know, no reason to sit around necessarily for two more hours if you could get home that night. And, you know, the guys who are All-Stars, obviously, nobody's crying for guys who are Major League All-Stars and get to play in an All-Star game and all of that. At the same time, it is, you know, cutting short their only break that they get for an extended period of time during a season. Yeah. And that's valuable time both for physical and mental recuperation, also time to be spent with family and other significant people in one's life. It's a great job. It's not an easy job. If it were, it would not pay the millions and millions of dollars that it does. And one of the things it does is strain people physically and mentally, because they go a very long time having essentially no weekends and, you know, getting a day off every 2 or 3 weeks in most cases. The Cardinals, I think, are going to play 65 games in 72 days to finish out the year. You know, that's, again, I understand nobody's crying about for Major League Baseball players. At the same time, no matter what your job is, that's a pretty grueling stretch.
Just a little. Just only a little bit.
Yeah. Grueling. I mean, that's what, 10 weeks and 7 days off.
Yeah.
So you're not even batting at 50% weekends.
And even this break, if you think about it, if you're an All-Star,
right,
you're there Monday. Some of them were participating in the Home Run Derby. Then you're playing the game. You only really get 2 days off, and then you're back at it Friday.
Which goes to show you why, for the Cardinals and the Braves on Sunday, of all days, that a 4+ hour rain delay, or a combination of two delays to amount in 4+ hours of rain delay time, of all days, you don't want that. It's the day, the Sunday going into the All-Star break, because that time is so valuable to those guys to get out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of those, if they're planning on trying to go to Cancun for a few days, that puts a real dent in the plans. And, you know, I think we have this weird thing in this country, and probably other, I think in other countries too, it's not an American thing. Just because these guys make a lot of money and are famous, which people seem to think is a good thing, even though in most cases it's really not a good time. As a result of those things, people sort of lose any ability to put themselves in a player's shoes and reckon with what might be the downsides of these things.
Yeah.
Right? Like, nobody, you can discuss, here are some downsides with this, even while recognizing the upside, right? If somebody wins $1 billion in the lottery, you can say it kind of sucks that then every person you've ever known is now coming to you asking for money, treating you like an ATM, and it affects all your relationships. That doesn't mean we're saying, what a bummer that you won $1 billion, right? There can be, things can be mostly good and still have bad elements that you can talk about without saying the good things don't exist. And I think with athletes, that sometimes gets lost, because it is a challenging career path in many, many ways. And not the least of it is not getting breaks, especially during a baseball season. And so I can, you know, it's part of the reason that as many guys as we're seeing now opt out of the game and decide not to do it at all, because, you know, if it's going to mean you know, a cross-country flight there and back, and a couple of days essentially working, even if it's a pretty fun job, essentially working, when that time could be spent recuperating physically and mentally, spending time with people who don't get you don't get to spend a lot of time with during the course of a season, you know, I can understand why guys do that. Anyway, we got away a little bit from the swing off, but overall, good presentation. The reported number, I think, is around 7.2 million viewers, which keeps the All-Star Game well above both the Pro Bowl and the NBA All-Star Game as the most viewed All-Star Game around. Obviously, the NHL didn't have anything to compare it to this year because they scrapped the All-Star Game in favor of Four Nations, which was a resounding success for them, although probably not something that you can do every single year. We'll see exactly, you know, how they choose to figure that out in the future. I assume MLB benefits from the fact that they just have the sport, because of the way that the sport is played physically, they have the sport that is easiest to play for real in an All-Star game setting without overly risking injury and those other sorts of things. That, like, it doesn't require a tremendously high physical effort level from guys the way that asking NBA All-Stars to play defense does, or asking Pro Bowl players to hit each other at full blast does, right? Those are just different conversations than hitting a baseball, which is not an easy thing to do, but not necessarily risking injury in the same way those other sports are.
Yeah, because if you're a pitcher, all you're doing is you're going in and pitching one inning, at least most of the time now for the All-Star game. If a hitter, you're probably getting one at-bat, maybe two, and then fielding a couple more. So it's not really much you got to worry about if you're playing in it.
Jonathan Mayo will be with us next. He is an MLB draft analyst at MLB.com, and you'll hear his conversation coming up after the break on KMOX.
Braemar Sports Open Line continues. We're joined now by Jonathan Mayo of MLB.com to wrap up some of our conversations about the MLB draft on Sunday and Monday night, and in particular, the 21 players selected by the Cardinals. Jonathan, thanks so much for making some time for us during what I imagine is one of your busiest weeks of the year.
It's always a bit of a slog, but it's a slog of love. So happy to spend some time talking Cardinals draft with you.
Before we get to some of those Cardinals picks, it ties into certainly the Cardinals' first selection and really how the entire top of the draft went, that people were, I think, at least mildly surprised by Washington's selection of Eli Willits, the high school shortstop, at number one, and then very surprised by Tyler Bremner, the college right-hander out of UC Santa Barbara, going number two to the Angels, and that's part of why Liam Doyle fell down to the Cardinals at number five. On the scale of sort of 1 to 10, how surprising would you say those first two picks were in combination with one another?
I think he framed it pretty well in terms of mild surprise. You know, those of us who have spent the last several months constantly trying to figure out what's happening and talking to all the teams, especially Sunday as the clock started ticking, the idea of Eli Willits going number one overall was gaining a lot of steam. So by the time it happened, it wasn't that shocking. He was always in the conversation. Maybe it was more on the outskirts at first. But, you know, we've talked to scouts, not with the Nationals, who think that when all is said and done, he may be the best player from this draft. He's only 17. So if he gets stronger and adds impact, that's the one area of his game that was some concern, that he may be a superstar up the middle kind of player. So that was a mild surprise. So if you ask me 1 to 10, I'll say a 3. For the Angels, there's probably more like a 6, with the caveat that you always don't know what the Angels are going to do. My colleague Jim Callis, I think, put it best and said that if someone had told them that the Angels might take anyone in our top 20, that wouldn't be shocking. And Bremner was 18. So he kind of fit within that, those parameters. But yeah, it was a little bit of a surprise, you know, but the Angels like to cut deals with players that they think can move quickly. And they've had some success with it. You know, Christian Moore's in the big leagues. So, you know, it was more of a surprise, but given the Angels' MO, it wasn't as shocking as it would have been had it been another organization.
You mentioned Christian Moore. The Cardinals took a couple of guys at the top of the draft with their first and third picks, both out of Tennessee, including Liam Doyle at number 5 overall. I think the Cardinals would have to have been thrilled at the prospect if you told them pre-draft that Doyle would be there for them at number 5. Probably couldn't have gone a whole lot better for them at that first pick.
No, I think that's right. They really love Eli Willis. And I think if things had flipped around a little bit, that very well could have happened, because it didn't seem likely that he was going to go 2, 3, or 4. And I think then they would have been stuck with the decision of Liam Doyle or Eli Willis. I think they probably were contemplating Parker as well and making that decision. But Doyle led that group. Doyle was an interesting one because, you know, I think most people thought he was firmly in the Angels' purview at number two. And I think he definitely was up to a point. But if he didn't go two, the Mariners at 3 and the Rockies at 4 were not likely to take him. So there was a good chance the Cardinals were going to get him. I think they just thought that he seemed like a really good fit for the Angels at 2. So I think they had to have been thrilled that a guy that they've liked all along was there for them to consider, even if they had decided to go in the high school shortstop direction. Just being able to consider Doyle was a win. And then, you know, especially because Willis was gone, then it made even more sense for them to take the lefty out of Tennessee.
You mentioned their interest in Willis. Maybe interestingly, in the end, they took 21 players. Only one of them was a high school kid, Ryan Mitchell, with their second pick, outfielder, high school kid from Tennessee. Does that surprise you at all to see them going so heavy in a college direction?
Not really. You know, I think that the strength of the class overall was high school shortstops. And they had one, maybe two, that they were really interested in. You know, we talked about Willis. I think JoJo Parker was the other one. And, you know, he went a couple of picks later. So after that, then I think that, you know, the Cardinals are probably a pretty model-driven team. And there are certain things, you know, that needed to be checked off. They did get, you know, a pretty interesting position player in Ryan Mitchell, you know, has a chance to be a really good left-handed bat. There should be some decent power. He's, you know, got good bat speed. You know, I think it was interesting. He played shortstop in high school, but they announced him as an outfielder. That's probably a better fit anyway, or second base. But, you know, let him go out in center field where his athleticism would really play. And then after that, you know, once all the sort of top tier of the high school bats were taken, once you get deeper into the draft, and it's more about the depth of this draft, and I think the depth was on the college side.
Is there anybody who stands out to you outside of maybe those top few guys that we spent the last couple of days talking about in the Cardinals class that you really like for value or maybe really dislike for some other reason?
Yeah, you, Jack Gervich is kind of interesting to me. So Jim Callis and I split the country up, and I have California in our draft coverage. And he is a guy who has some interesting qualities as, again, another left-handed hitter. He's a draft-eligible sophomore. He's probably destined to play first base. He's not the biggest guy in the world. It's a little bit of a weird profile, but he's like this gritty player. He makes loud contact. You know, he's gonna have to tone down the aggressiveness at the plate a little bit in the chase, but I think it'll be toned down. But you know, it's kind of gap power, and I think there's more pop to come. So he might be an interesting one to watch as a guy who, because of the bat to ball skills, that's a really good foundation. And if he can get him to kind of tone it down a little bit, he may end up being a really, really good big league hitter, probably at first base. Maybe, you know, he's played some third, maybe you try it there. But I think the fact that they announced him as a first baseman, not that they're beholden to where they announce him as, but that's often a sign of where they think he'll at least start things out. But, you know, I'd move him around a little bit and see if he's capable of playing anywhere else, just because first base, you know, right-handed throwing 6-foot first baseman, there aren't that many of those. But the bat characteristics, I think, are why he went in the third round.
We're visiting with Jonathan Mayo of MLB.com. You can follow him on Twitter, at Jonathan Mayo. Jonathan, real quick before we let you go, I think the MLB draft, maybe just in my circles, but I think a little bit wider than that, is starting to grow in these last couple of years as a kind of an event that gets on the radar of fans and is becoming a little bit more of a quote-unquote spectator sport in the way that some other drafts can be. Is there anything that you found yourself having to clarify with fans who are just coming to the draft for the first year or two recently? Maybe they've been longstanding baseball fans, but just misconceptions or other teaching points that you've been trying to get out there to people as they start to embrace following the draft?
Well, I think the big thing is the bonus pool. It's different. Your other drafts, maybe they have strict slots. And obviously, the big divide between baseball and other sports is that in other sports, you draft a guy and he's in your starting lineup at the highest level right away. We're seeing more and more draftees get to the big leagues faster, and that's probably driven interests somewhat. Having the drafted all-star, I think, helps in that regard. But in terms of the machinations of the draft itself, it's the bonus pool, and you know some teams will kind of manipulate what they spend where. You don't have to draft a guy and sign him to the amount that pick value is. So it's not always, oh, who is the best player? I think high end the draft in the first round, especially, that's what teams should do. But especially in a year like this, where the group at the top, maybe throughout the draft, you could argue, is kind of muddled together. So if all things are being equal, if you can get a guy and then save money and then aggressively go after a guy in a later round, then you do that. Or a lot of teams do that. And I think that's the one thing where I saw even people after this draft upset that, say, Ethan Holliday didn't go number one overall and the Nationals took Eli Willits. It wasn't that large of a reach. We had him number five, and like I said, a lot of scouts really, really liked him. But I think it's that sort of manipulation of a bonus pool that the casual fan just coming to the draft for the first time doesn't naturally get. And I think that takes some time to sort of understand how that could work.
Well, Jonathan, we appreciate your coverage, and thanks a lot for making some time for us.
Thanks for having me. Anytime.
Jonathan Mayo of MLB.com joining us on KMOX. You can follow him on Twitter at Jonathan Mayo. We'll have Dan Reardon, KMOX golf analyst, talking the Open Championship next. Graybar Sports Open Line continues after this.
Graybar Sports Open Line continues on this Wednesday evening. Nate Gatter in for Matt Pauly. He will be back on Friday. We are joined now by KMOX golf analyst Dan Reardon. You can follow Dan on Twitter at DanReardon13. And his services are desperately required because the Open Championship tees off in just about 5 hours from Royal Portrush in Northern Ireland. And Dan is going to have to make sense of it all for us. Dan, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine, and thanks for the invitation, Nate.
Well, it's great to have you with us. Let's start with what I imagine is probably the biggest storyline, at least in a narrative sense, around this tournament, which is Rory McIlroy back in his homeland at a course where he once shot a course record 61, but the pressure of the Open at Royal Portrush seemed to get to him. That 61 was prior to his career as a professional. When he was back there for the Open Championship in 2019, he started with a quadruple bogey on the first tee. He ended up at 8 over 79 in the first round, and it really never got going for him. Do you think because of maybe some of the changes we've seen in Rory McIlroy, not only on the course but off of it in the last 6 years, that he might be better prepared to handle the pressure and expectations that will come along with this weekend, particularly for him?
Well, I think there's no question he's better prepared, and even more so this year, Nate, because he's apparently passed what I would describe the PTSD that he experienced after completing the career slam and winning the Masters Championship. He went into sort of a dark area, got in some issues with the press, and seemed to be revitalized, even at Travelers, but more recently at the Scottish Open. So he'll go in, I think, in a better frame of mind. And he freely admitted in his tournament pre-tournament press conference that the amount of attention he got when he teed off in 2019 in that event stunned him. He didn't realize how big a deal it was to the golf public in Ireland that he was in their field. So, he'll be better prepared. But then the flip side of that, I think there's probably even more pressure on him because of all those circumstances. I don't know that there is a player in the field who will feel more pressure at the start of the round tomorrow than Rory McIlroy.
What about Scottie Scheffler, who obviously is the favorite, if not the overwhelming favorite, in almost every tournament he plays these days? He has not been bad by any stretch in his opportunities at the Open, including a tie for seventh at Royal Troon last year, but he also has not finished in the top three. It's the only major where he hasn't managed a top three finish in his career. Obviously, we're holding Scottie to Scottie standards in even quoting that kind of a statistic as though it's some kind of bad thing. But it's a little bit of an unusual situation in the sense that they're playing links golf that most of these guys, the Americans on tour, don't play very often. Maybe the course is a little bit of an equalizer or a randomizer in that sense, the weather, all of those things. In your mind, does that mean Scottie should be at least less of a favorite this weekend than he ordinarily would be?
The first thing I would say about Scheffler is he's the most reliable contender in a major since Tiger Woods. In other words, when he shows up, he tends to compete and contend. Having said that, you need to realize that, yes, this is a links course, but this is an Irish links course. And people who are accustomed to seeing the Open Championship, which literally goes back to the first year that Abraham Lincoln was sworn into office, that the Open Championship is played on typically flat links courses in Scotland and England that are somewhat brown in nature. What they will see tomorrow and through the weekend is a very green golf course that uses terrain a lot more than any place else. So Scheffler and everybody else in the field will face a different challenge this week at Royal Portrush than they would face a year ago or at St. Andrews. At any other, the only three times they've played in Ireland, they've been at Royal Portrush, and everything else has been in Scotland, Wales, or England. So you have a different circumstance in that regard. As it applies to Scottie Scheffler, and I always like to go through the interviews in advance, I would encourage anybody to go out and find online the last 5 minutes of Scottie Scheffler's interview leading into the Open Championship. He stunned the room. He gave a five-minute presentation inside his mind of what his philosophical attitude toward being a professional athlete involved. And he's gotten some criticism because he basically lives for the moment and doesn't put as high a priority as at winning the championship as maybe everybody else, including Rory, puts in the game. He says his description was he loves professional golf. It's what he wants to do most in life. But he says he finds the game for him satisfying, but not fulfilling. And he finds fulfillment off the golf course.
Yeah, it's an interesting perspective. He almost sounded like a regular guy talking about his career that he really enjoys, but that is just his career. And, you know, it's understandable that for some of these guys, that's how they would feel about it. But it's not necessarily how we as fans feel about it, right? So many people would give a limb to be able to go out and play professional golf for a living that it's just foreign to them to think of that like having another job. And again, I don't think from those comments that Scottie intended any disrespect or intended to communicate any level of arrogance or taking it for granted what he has. But it was interesting not only that he has the perspective, but that he chose to articulate it so well and so clearly in front of a lot of people, a lot of cameras, at a really big moment in the season and his career.
When he stood up following the interview, the moderator said to him quietly, "That was fascinating." And briefly about the golf part of Scottie Scheffler and starting tomorrow. Scheffler, if he has kryptonite in golf, it's on the greens. He's not a spectacular putter. He has good days. The Open Championship rarely is won by the best putter in the field. Cameron Smith would be the exception to that at St. Andrews when he beat Rory McIlroy. So I think that playing the Open Championship, if he gets off to a good start, I think Scheffler will enjoy. If the speeds on the greens are not an issue for him, I think he'll be very successful. Whether he wins or not, that's as much dependent on the rest of the field as it is on him.
Dan Reardon, KMOX golf analyst, is with us talking about the Open Championship, which will tee off in now just a little under 5 hours, 12:35 Central Time, across the pond at Royal Portrush in Northern Ireland. Scottie Scheffler and Rory McIlroy, we've talked about the world number one and two, Rory in particular carrying that sort of hometown hero status into the tournament. Xander Schauffele is the defending champion. Shane Lowry, an Irishman, won the last Open Championship played at Royal Portrush in 2019. John Rahm maybe will have his eye on things. Justin Rose has played well and had some success at Open Championships. Is there anybody else out of kind of that next tier? It feels like Scottie is the top tier on his own. Rory is maybe tier number two at times on his own. Certainly he's going to get the second most attention and the most attention there locally. Is there anybody in that next group who really stands out to you for whatever reason this weekend?
As strange as it may seem, Nate, when I look at the field going in, particularly for this championship, which is always impacted by weather, and the weather is supposed to be similar to the last time, a lot of rain and cold temperatures and a little bit of wind, I look at the tee times the first two days to see where you are in the draw, because the weather in Scotland or in Ireland tends to be morning and afternoon weather, and they're very distinctly different. And the weather tomorrow morning is supposed to be the best of the 4 days, and then it gets rainy the rest of the way. So when I look at the field, I look at who's at the top of the draw, who gets off to the good start, and who's at the bottom of the draw, who gets off to the bad start. It equalizes when you get to the weekend. Well, at the top of the draw, you have Schauffele, you have Scheffler, and you have Colin Morikawa. They're all going out roughly around 4 o'clock St. Louis time. At the bottom of the draw, you have three groups going out in succession around 9 o'clock St. Louis time. The first one is McIntyre, DeChambeau, and Rose. Two major winners in that group. The next group is Spieth, Oberg, and Hovland. Keep an eye on Spieth. He just gave his wife just gave birth to their child. He hasn't had any playing time in competition since Travelers, but he's been successful in this championship. And the group after them is McIlroy, Thomas, and Tommy Fleetwood. And Fleetwood is another name that I would consider. Those are great groups. They probably are going to play in the worst of the weather over the first 2 days.
Well, Dan, I got to ask you one more thing, especially, it's not a new thing that the Open Championship would be played, especially the initial couple of rounds, at awkward times for the Midwestern American viewer. What's your plan? Are we snorting Mountain Dew and staying up all night? Are we going to bed and you've got an alarm set for the wee hours? How are we approaching this? If you're a veteran of golf and the Open Championship, what's the move here?
I've been known to get up as early as 4 a.m. to watch the championships. As I've gotten a little older, I've become a little more patient. And the truth of the matter is that the first 2 days are staging, so it's not as critical that you see everything going on. Although I think it's fun because of the weather. I think it's fun to see the players battle the elements and to see all those things. And one other thing about this championship, they are expecting, if the weather doesn't produce a negative, they're expecting the largest crowds in the history of the Open Championship. They're thinking they can get close to 300,000, and I think the record is held by St. Andrews somewhere in the low 290s. But no, I will be up in before the sun watching this championship.
Well, Dan, we're really looking forward to watching it with you. I think it was John Rahm I saw say this week that, you know, he considers the Open Championship to be the most prestigious trophy still available to win in golf. And I think, you know, it's interesting to get that perspective, especially for a European player. I wonder if the American mind, especially in the last, you know, in the 21st century, let's say, has become so Masters-centric in that being the pinnacle of the golf calendar and kind of getting a different treatment from at least the other American golf tournaments, that we forget, you know, the additional level of history behind this tournament, behind this trophy, and especially for the European players, you know, what it means to be in this field.
It's the most international of the four majors, and credit Arnold Palmer, who in 1960 gave it his seal of approval and made it acceptable for American golfers to go over. And since that time, we've seen that. And I guess it all culminated during the time of Tiger Woods, when Tiger goes to St. Andrews and just blows that golf course away. And now it's stayed on everybody's map since that time.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear Rahm's comments that he then said, and obviously not every Open Championship is exactly the same. There's sort of a hierarchy, and the absolute best thing you could do in golf is win the Open Championship at St. Andrews. So he's putting that on even a pedestal of its own.
And luck does come into play more in this championship than everything else because of the nature of the golf courses.
Well, Dan, we appreciate you so much, and we'll have you right back on here tomorrow evening to give us the important stuff from the first round and look ahead to round two.
Enjoyed visiting with you, Nate.
Dan Reardon joining us here on Campbell X to talk the Open Championship that tees off in a little under 5 hours, 12:35 St. Louis time. The first round from Royal Portrush in Northern Ireland. And that will, again, be Dan Reardon's area of expertise tomorrow evening. He will join us just after the top of the hour at 7:05 tomorrow evening. We got a packed show coming up tomorrow. Remind you about all of that after our interview with Ed Wheatley coming up next. But we'll be doing some St. Louis Cardinals, some Open Championship, also some Mizzou football because they'll have their SEC Media Days appearance tomorrow morning. All of that on Sports Open Line tomorrow evening. First, though, we'll take a break. Ed Wheatley of the St. Louis Browns Historical Society joins me next on KMOX. Graybar Sports Open Line continues, and we're joined by the president of the St. Louis Browns Historical Society, Ed Wheatley, the author of several books, including St. Louis Browns, The Story of a Beloved Team. Ed, I always enjoy our conversations. It's never a bad time to talk about the history of baseball in St. Louis. In particular, I think this is an interesting time for the St. Louis Browns in the history of the club because a couple of weeks ago, Billy Hunter, who also happens to be my great uncle, passed away, and he was the last living player who had appeared for the Browns, an all-star in 1953 as the Browns shortstop in their last season in St. Louis before moving to Baltimore. And so in many ways, you're now ushering the Historical Society into a new era of St. Louis Browns history.
Yeah, but, you know, that's not going to really change anything. I mean, if you look back, it was a tough week a couple weeks ago when Eddie Mickelson died on the 27th, and he was the second to last, and then Billy on July 3rd. So within that span of a week, we lost the last two. You know, the Boston Braves do not have any surviving members either, and the New York Giants and the Brooklyn Dodgers are just down to a handful single-digit numbers now as well, and they'll have a kind of a countdown. But, you know, what we have here is very special in St. Louis. You know, it really does help that foundational statement that St. Louis is the best baseball town in America because, you know, the Browns haven't played in 72 years, and we are the only active participating fan club. It's not just old guys who watch the team. It's the generations that are still living that have watched it. Their children and even grandchildren show up. You know, we have, as I said, we're very active. There's nothing being active for the Brooklyn Dodgers, the New York Giants, the Philadelphia A's, or the Boston Braves. We'll have next month two events that over hundreds, and in the case of 1,000s, will attend honoring the Browns. And so, you know, we've been doing this. We'll have an annual reunion luncheon. We've been doing it every year since 1984. It'll be at the MAC on August 25th. And what we do is we remember the history of the Browns and the legacy of baseball in St. Louis. And on that day, we expect 300 to 400 people at the MAC for a luncheon. We're going to bring in Babe Ruth's grandson and talk about the Babe in St. Louis, his time playing against the Browns and his time playing against the Cardinals in the 26 and 28 World Series. And also, people don't really realize Babe Ruth's farewell was not in New York. There's always, anytime you say words, Babe Ruth's farewell, you see that Pulitzer Prize winning photo of the Babe from behind in his uniform looking out at the facade at Yankee Stadium. It really happened the following week. In June, here in St. Louis, Sportsman's Park, where he came, and it was a very special day of Babe Ruth memories and things. And his grandson's coming in, and we're gonna go through all this stuff along with a lot of Babe Ruth and Browns memorabilia. And we then also, just to throw it out, a plug on the preceding week on August 14th, we have Browns Night at the Gateway Grizzlies every year. And every year, I pick a year we dress the Grizzlies in a retro Browns uniform, highlighting a given player and his performance that year, and then we give away his bobblehead. And we have thousands of people there coming for that great event, all dressed in Brownie hats, jerseys, t-shirts, whatever.
That was actually how you and I first met. I was doing play-by-play for the Grizzlies when they started doing St. Louis Browns Nights in 2018. So much fun. you know, a lot of minor league baseball teams do sort of fluky or gimmicky marketing schemes that really feel like gimmicks, but the Grizzlies and Browns Historical Society have managed to create one that has all the fun of minor league baseball themed nights, but is also very substantive and honors really significant history in our city. I always thought that was just a great way to connect it with the new generation of people who otherwise might not have been exposed in the same way.
Oh, yeah. You know, and you're right. You know, you may have heard my father or my grandfather always had a Browns hat, or he had these pennants in his house. And there, people were learning, you know, from coming to these events. You know, we've written a best-selling book in that same period that led to two PBS Emmy-nominated and winning films. So we have really pushed the envelope to get people cognizant of the Browns and then start participating and keeping that legacy alive. Because, you know, it's like I said, you know, they still have Civil War reunions. They have World War I, World War II reunions. None of those gentlemen are still alive. And we can carry the torch. And we've been doing that the last several years. I had some of them participating by Zoom. I think we had our last participatory former Brownie in 2020. So we've been able to carry this torch, and I don't see it stopping. We bring in great guests. Last year we had Mike Vec, Bill Vec's son, who was right there, his right-hand man through all the craziness of baseball history with Bill. And we will continue to, like I said, this week, this coming year, it's Babe Ruth's grandson. Very, very special man. Very, very special memories. Because there's a lot of things tied between the Browns and Babe Ruth. And is there anybody better to talk about baseball than Babe Ruth?
For people who might be hearing this and thinking about wanting to learn more, get involved, what's the best way for them to do it?
Well, the best thing, you can go to our website, stlbrowns.com, and it'll pull up all the very, you know, informative website. You can see our activities, how you can be a member and join with us, and you can see the history of the events we've done, the history of these men. And but it'll give all the details about both of these events that I'm speaking about.
Well, we appreciate your time so much, as always, and we appreciate the great work that you and your colleagues do to keep this history alive for all of us to deservedly take pride in and enjoy around this city. Thank you very, very much for being here.
Well, I appreciate the time. Thank you very much.
Ed Wheatley joining us this evening, the president of the St. Louis Browns Historical Society on KMOX. Graybar Sports Open Line wrapping up. Nate Gatter in for Matt Pauly, and tomorrow will be our final show together before Matt returns for Cardinals baseball on Friday evening when they come out of the All-Star break against the Arizona Diamondbacks on the road in Phoenix. Tomorrow night, we will have Ben Hockman of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch with us to talk about the Cardinals. We'll wrap up those MLB draft conversations as well with Sam Dykstra of MLB Pipeline. Dan Reardon, who was with us a few moments ago, will be back to analyze the first round of the Open Championship from Royal Portrush and get us set for the second round on Friday. We'll also visit with Mizzou football beat writer Zach Sweet after the Tigers make their appearances at SEC Media Days tomorrow morning. And we'll look forward to sort of dipping a toe in that football water as the kickoff of college football approaches very, very quickly. Week zero, August 23rd will be the first action. Missouri will begin its season with what has become traditional, the Thursday night home game. It'll be August the 28th, and then week one across the entire country proper on August 30th, that Saturday. So college football, not a long way. Cardinals, Mizzou, Open Championship, and more coming up tomorrow evening. For John Camp, my producer, Nate Gatter, filling in for Matt Pauly, saying so long tonight. Thanks so much for being with us for Graybar Sports Open Line on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.